from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Australian officials lifted the media blackout on the trial and conviction of Cardinal George Pell, former Archbishop of Sydney, this week. While he was convicted in December, the world now officially knows that one of the highest-ranking Vatican officials has been convicted of historical sexual abuse. Was it a fair trial? Will the Vatican now put him on trial as well? The Register's Vatican correspondent, Edward Penton, reports on this from Rome. I'm Jeanette DiMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio. I'm joined by Matthew Bunsen, the Register's senior editor and co-host of this show, Register Radio. Welcome back, Matthew, from Rome.
Very good to be with you.
So we've got some very serious news to talk about today. Cardinal Pell also held a high place in the Vatican. Not only was he the senior prelate in Australia, he was prefect of the economy, and he sat on the Council of Cardinals for Pope Francis. And now he's in the most unlikely of places. He's in prison. How did this happen? We have Edward, who's been following this news from the beginning. Edward, welcome.
Hi, good to be with you, Jeanette.
Edward, this is just tremendously sad news for the church. You've been following this from the beginning. Can you, give us what was the most recent decision?
Yes, well, the most recent decision was really that Cardinal Pell was denied bail, which he'd requested, his lawyers had requested, and he's now being held in custody until the appeal, until the verdict, rather, is, sorry, the sentence is given, which will be, I believe, on March 13th, so a couple of weeks now. So it's now, until that happens, Cardinal Pell cannot lodge, well, he's lodged an appeal, but he won't get an appeal date. So he's got, this could be a long process going on for many months. And all that time he'll be held in custody. So it's a tragic time for him and for the church, yeah.
So the conviction was over historic sexual abuse. What does this mean? There were two cases, correct?
Yes. The good news that came out for the cardinal this week was that one of those trials has been dropped. It was a trial that was going to happen this month. That's been dropped. There wasn't enough, a strong enough case. And so that was in his favor. And in fact, a lot of cases that have been brought against him have been dropped, except for this one, which he's found guilty of. And that verdict came in December. There was a suppression order, which stopped being able to be reported in Australia. And then a lot of big agencies couldn't report on it either until that suppression order was lifted this week. But yes, it's and the case involves two choristers who claim to have been sexually abused in the sacristy after mass in the late 1990s. One of the plaintiffs has died, one of the victims, and the other took the case to court. And the important thing to point out here is that there was a mistrial. The mistrial back in September showed that Cardinal Pell actually actually had the support of 10 members of the jury against 2 on this case. And then when the retrial was done, he lost the case and was found guilty, obviously 12-0. So it was a very interesting turnaround there, and it makes people a bit suspicious about it.
Absolutely. You know, we have a commentary on ncregister.com from Father Raymond D'Souza, and his commentary, the gist of it is that this amounts to a religious persecution in Australia. And he basically says that the prosecution was really biased from the beginning. It's something that's very much worth reading. One of the choristers that you were speaking of, the one who has now died, he actually denied ever having been abused to his mother before he died. So he was not one of the people who have brought this claim forward. I think that that's a rather interesting fact that hasn't gotten out there. And also another fact that Father Raymond raises is that the testimony of this man who claims the abuse he gave the testimony live in the first trial, in the first hearing. And in the second, before the second jury, it was not live. It was a recording or a written testimony. And so it just makes you wonder if that might have swayed the jury as well. What are you hearing in terms of the judiciousness of the process?
Well, there is a lot of concern about it. And I mean, even though as people who aren't supporters of the cardinal are voicing skepticism about this case and casting doubts on how it's been conducted and the people just think it's unbelievable. I mean, the cardinal's friends, some of them I've spoken to, they just can't believe he'd be capable of the kind of allegation he's been found guilty of, and they feel that there must be some other connection. And you've heard that theories going around, you know, that it's because the cardinal was doing his job too well here and getting under a lot of people's noses and on the financial issues and uncovering financial corruption in the Vatican, and they feel that perhaps there was some sort of orchestrated setup to get him out of the Vatican, knowing that he had a lot of opposition in Australia, and there were already cases that that he'd been sort of accused of covering up, or at least not covering up, but being negligent of. And I think they felt there was some sort of setup there to get him out and to get him over to Australia. And certainly the timing of this case is rather suspicious. I mean, it came, the courts in Australia asked the cardinal to go back to Australia to face charges just a week after the Auditor General of the Vatican was summarily dismissed for which charges, which we found out later, were set up. It was fabricated charges against him. So there's a lot of complicated background to this, and which I think has a lot of people thinking that it's not as straight as it seems. And there's a lot of sort of suspicions goings on in the back,
but in the background here. Doesn't this raise some serious questions about the Australian courts as well as the Australian media? But is it possible now for a Catholic figure of Cardinal Pell's prominence to get a fair trial?
Well, this is it, Matthew. I mean, if that's the case, and, you know, we have a sort of, dare I say, a kangaroo court over there, and when it comes to clerical abuse cases, this is a serious problem because, you know, it sets a very bad precedent. This is what I'm hearing, that if you cannot depend on the rule of law for cases like this, what sort of precedent does that term set for other similar cases? And I think people are very concerned that if there is a real travesty of justice here, what does that mean going forward, and how could this be applied to other such cases?
You know, even on December 13th, and this is something that Catholic News Agency was able to report back then, because they did not allow their articles to appear in Australia. They were able to block them. But on December 13th, the Victoria State Attorney General actually pointed to the dangers of negative media coverage during having an influence on the jury. So it seems as though there is an awareness, as you said, Edward, from people who are not supporters of the cardinal, there's an awareness that this is this has been a problem. So it's important to recognize that. And I think you also have written about the exoneration of Archbishop Philip Wilson as well in Australia.
That's right. Yes, and that was, I think, because, if I'm not mistaken, I think there was concerns about how that case had been negatively influenced by outside elements like the media. And that is a concern here too. And people have spoken about the vitriol that's felt against Cardinal Pell, but they're using that, the sort of anger they felt about the church and the whole abuse crisis, and they're directing it totally at Cardinal Pell as a kind of the bogeyman to deal with this. And that's a serious problem. But as you say, I think they are aware of that. So, but whether that sort of holds sway and they consider that when the appeal comes, we'll have to see, I suppose.
Sure. So Archbishop Philip Wilson was able to appeal, and it was the appellate judge who did say that the media's portrayal of the church and the sexual abuse crisis as a whole was a factor. describe again the process here with Cardinal Pell. What might that process be in terms of appeals?
Yes, well, I mean, his lawyers are very confident that they can win this appeal. That they've got. I heard from one source. He said he's seen the legal case, and he said it's formidable, and that there really is a good chance that the appeal will succeed. And I think a lot of his supporters, or some of his supporters at least, I think felt, well, you know, he's got to be found guilty, but we'll win on appeal, and we've just got to see this process through. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what they felt. But you know, it's until then, it's anything goes. And of course, the Vatican now is saying, well, we're going to have a. They announced this week that they're going to start canonical proceedings in their own way to look at this case and deal with it canonically, because of course the Vatican needs to look at this too. If the cardinal is guilty, or if the guilty verdict is upheld, then they have to look at it and see if it, you know, leads to possibly removal from the College of Cardinals, perhaps even laicization like Theodore McCarrick. But that's something that they're looking at. So,
at least, should be considered almost unthinkable.
Yes, at the moment, yes. And somebody pointed out, actually, that, you know, you could have the situation where the civil courts have found him guilty, but the canonical courts find him innocent, and then what happens? So it's a really difficult problem. And of course, this is all uncharted waters here, because this has never happened at the Vatican, at least in modern history, where you've had a most senior cardinal Vatican official having this happen to him, and being held in custody and found guilty in civil courts like this. So there's a lot of unknowns going forward, I think.
And Edward, how is the cardinal's health?
Well, I've heard that he actually fairly recently he was pretty down and depressed. I think he got happier, from what I understand, when he thought that the appeal was going to go through. But I also hear that he's being very stoic, and he's really willing to see this through to the end, and mm-hmm. he's absolutely convinced of his innocence. And of course, it's worth remembering that he didn't actually have to go back to Australia to face these charges. He could have pleaded, you know, with diplomatic immunity and stayed in the Vatican. But he felt so confident that he would win it that he decided to go back and face the charges. So, well, it's very difficult for him, I think. I think he's absolutely convinced of his innocence. And
his heart troubles that he had had in previous years, he's been stable in that regard.
Yes, I think so. As far as I know, I think his health is okay in that regard. But yes, that's one of the reasons why he was also warned not to go back, is because of his heart trouble. He might not. It's not good for his heart to go such long distances. So, but he seems to be okay, I think, health wise, as far as I know.
Sure. Well, Edward, as always, thank you for your reporting. Most of the stuff you have to cover these days is very heavy.
Pretty grim.
Yeah, yes. Pretty grim for the church. I appreciate that you plug through and that you bring us the news as it is, and we pray for you and for your health as you continue to try to report. When we come back, Matthew and I catch up with what is happening in the news in general, a little bit about the summit, and we look ahead to what may be expected in sexual abuse reform, but we also talk about Lent, which is right around the corner. This is Register Radio. More when we return.
Don't miss a moment of 2019. Try 6 issues of EWTN's National Catholic Register today for free. Award-winning journalism that goes beyond what you'll find from any secular news service. With the Register, you'll get the real story behind the events that unfold over the course of the year. Try the Register for free today and get it delivered to your home, office, or parish. Want to continue your subscription after your free trial? Just pay $49.95 and you'll get a total of 26 issues filled with spiritual insights on world events, along with compelling Catholic news and information. To get 6 free issues, order online at ncregister.com/NYR or call 800-421-3230 and mention code 919-NYRA. The National Catholic Register. Read faithfully.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register and your host of Register Radio. I'm joined by Matthew Bunsen, my co-host. Matthew's in Washington, D.C. right now, but Matthew, you just returned from Rome, right?
I did. I was there for the whole of the Sex Abuse Summit, and it was always a great joy to be able to work with all of our EWTN colleagues in Rome.
A joy, but it's also very heavy.
It was.
This material is just very difficult for us to cover. It's a reliving for those of us who were covering the news back in 2002. It's, you know, reliving that, but on steroids. I mean, this is just crazy, the amount of sadness that goes around in covering this. But Matthew, from being there and talking to people who were on the ground, did the summit succeed, I guess we should say?
Well, I think that the best way we can describe it is we don't know yet. And I say that because everyone had very high expectations going in. The Holy Father tried to deflate those expectations. Then at the very start of the summit, he uses this important phrase where he says, we have to avoid easy condemnations and work for concrete results. So it's a fair question, were there concrete results? Well, I would argue that there's potential of concrete results coming out of this.
Absolutely, because there were several lists, either given by the Holy Father or by Cardinal Supich, for example, people who were a part of the planning of this, list of almost like checklists that could be done in concrete ways after the fact. What were some of those ideas?
Yeah, well, this was a summit or a meeting that had a lot of lists. we had the 21 points of reflection by Pope Francis at the start of the meeting. We had 8 points that he wanted the world to embrace and the church to embrace in dealing with the sexual abuse crisis in his final speech. And then Cardinal Supich in his presentation had 12 items that he would hope, or at least certainly that the Holy See would hope, that the bishops' conferences around the world will embrace as part of accountability. The best way to describe Cardinal Supich's plan is it's called the Metropolitan Model, and basically what it does is it bases holding bishops accountable through the Metropolitan, who is the senior Catholic leader in a province or a region. Think of it mostly as a state. For example, the Archbishop of Philadelphia, Archbishop Chaput, is metropolitan for his province. So it's a significant way of dealing with it because it keeps it within the church, but then it also needs to take into account lay involvement. And that certainly was a theme that was constant throughout this summit.
And of course, that idea is not a new idea. I mean, this has historical precedence to have the Metropolitan have some authority, and it's something that has been talked about already. Do you know if this is likely to be the U.S. Bishop's plan?
My suspicion is that the USCCB officials, headed, of course, by Cardinal Daniel DiNardo, are coming back to Washington, D.C., and they're starting their work. And what I imagine is going to happen is that they will take many of the core principles here and try to apply them as closely as possible to what I think will be a plan voted on or at least seriously deliberated in June. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think this will serve as a foundation for discussions. Now, it's going to be an open question as to how many plans are going to be issued or proposed at the June meeting and the plan that they end up with. But the other thing that I think we can safely say is that coming into this meeting, there's going to be a lot more conversation between the USCCB and the Holy See than took place last fall.
Matthew, you mentioned that there were a lot of expectations.
Yes.
Well, you know, I mean, there are 190 bishops gathered, there are experts gathered, there were over 300 media gathered, and one of the people, you know, who were putting a lot, I guess not one of the people, one of the groups that were putting a lot of expectations out there are victims groups of various kinds. What was the atmosphere like on the ground as you walked, down Conciliazione or across St. Peter's Square? What were you seeing?
Well, you could see not just on the Via della Conciliazione, but you could see it across the whole city because there were a number of locations in the lead up to the summit and then even during the summit of protests and press conferences from a variety of victims' groups. And I had a chance to talk with a number of representatives of these different groups. And their expectations were understandably high coming in. And they wanted to be heard above all. And I think it's safe to say that at this summit, their voices were definitely front and center before the bishops. There were a variety of media forms in which they were heard or they could be read. Out in the street, however, by the end of the summit, I think there was a general level of dissatisfaction. I think they felt that it just wasn't complete. And without the sorts of concrete statements and other things coming out of this, they were frustrated. Now, other victims groups and other survivors groups would say this is at least significant because it had never happened before.
Right.
We'd never seen this kind of a gathering, and that's a very fair comment to make.
Absolutely, and to the bishops' credit, the bishops who were gathered and to those who planned this, to their credit, and they said this over and over again, this is about a change of heart, and the change of heart has to happen before the change of policy, otherwise the policies are empty and are broken. So that makes sense. It's just that people are ready for change, so I can understand the frustration as well. Matthew, before we move on to another important topic, which is Lent, you wrote an analysis and it mentioned the McCarrick test, that the success of this summit is going to be measured by the McCarrick test. In a nutshell,
yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what it means is that everything that's going to be proposed, the name Theodore McCarrick, ex-cardinal, now Mr. Theodore McCarrick, is going to come up. If there's a metropolitan model being proposed, how are the bishops going to answer the question, well, Theodore McCarrick was a metropolitan, so how can we trust this? It flows in a way from a question that CNN correspondent Delia Gallagher asked at one of the Vatican press conferences during the summit. She said in 2002, the U.S. cardinals came to Rome and promised us a zero tolerance, and the main voice for that was Theodore McCarrick. So her question was, how do we trust you? So McCarrick, in a way, becomes a litmus test for everything mm-hmm. they're doing. But above all, the transparency that has been promised in revealing the details of this case. And we have, as yet, no clear answers from Vatican officials or even American dioceses as to where things stand and who knew what, when, and where.
Right, right. Well, this already has felt like a very long Lent, and we are now just entering the true season of Lent in the church, the liturgical season that helps us to look at ourselves and offer ourselves in fasting and penance and almsgiving to Christ anew. It's a very important time. I'm looking forward to it because it always feels like an opportunity to realign myself and make sure that I'm with Christ. I haven't jumped ship, you know. So Matthew, what should we look from the Vatican at least for the season of Lent? Are there things that are beginning to happen there that we should stay attuned to?
Yes, well, we've had the Holy Father's statement that he tied to a new creation. So we're seeing in a way the opportunity in Lent to be recreated, and of course to be recreated in Christ through Christ, to avail ourselves of these days. To turn to him. But also, as is often the case, people are very interested in the Lenten retreat that the Holy Father is always holding, usually outside of Rome, so in Ariccia. And he has chosen for this retreat an abbot. His name is Father Bernardo Gianni. He's the abbot of a very famous monastery, San Miniato al Monte, which overlooks Florence. So let's put it this way. This is a monastery that has a pretty spectacular view, as they often do. And he will be the person who's directing the papal retreats. And historically, that's a very prominent post. And we'll have to see as we learn more about what his texts are going to be and what he's going to be focusing on.
All of those retreats offer us a chance to kind of retreat with the Pope and to reflect on what he's reflecting on. Of course, all of what we've been talking about can be found at the Register's website. Edward Penton wrote a blog about this Italian Benedictine who's leading the retreat. So you can read more about him there at ncregister.com. And Edward, as well as Father Raymond D'Souza, wrote about Cardinal Pell and his prosecution, and that can be read at the Register's website as well. But I want to turn attention just for a second to the print product. You know, soon our readers will have in their hands our Lenten editions, and in the Lenten editions are these wonderful guides for how to live Lent. The guides include, you know, how to return to confession, there's a beautiful Stations of the Cross there that it was written by Mother Angelica. And these are, you know, important ways that we try to help our readers enter better into the season of Lent. And I'll tease one fun story that's coming up, which Patty Armstrong is writing about the McFish sandwich at at McDonald's. So there's a lot on the Register's website and in our pages that we hope that our audience can find useful during Lent and can join with us in this penitential season.
And very briefly, that this has been a long Lent for the Church. It's been a long Lent for all of us as Catholics. Let's also use this time to help those who are struggling in the faith right now.
Mm-hmm. Amen. I say amen to that. And we ask our listeners here for prayers always in the reporting that we do. We appreciate every prayer you say for us. So remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks, as always, for joining us here on Register Radio on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless you.